You're tuned to The Weekend, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon. I'm Louis Sines, your host for The Weekend. And joining us today is Dr. Gregory Rocha. Dr. Rocha is a political science professor. And if you're an avid listener of KTEP, you are not... he's no stranger to KTEP. He's been with us throughout the years and helping us out. And this year... we have a lot to talk about, and particularly about what's going on with our current administration in Washington. But first, I'd like to welcome Greg to our show. Greg, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Louis.
Now, you and I have discussed this before with other presidents, and the fact that the first 100 days are usually something that they gauge the president by. So tell me, why is it the 100 days, and when did they start that?
Yeah, it started, Louis, in the... Roosevelt administration in 1933 after his election. And then he had pointed out that just give me 100 days and watch me pass legislation through the Congress that's going to alter our, you know, set of policies and try to turn around the then economic depression. And so it is that in that span of time, a flurry of legislation was passed and signed by the president that established the New Deal that is so historic. And along the way, people have come to accept that 100 days as something of an initial measure of how a president is doing during that time. And 100 days has this kind of nice round figure to it. And over time, I think we've come to understand that this is also a period when somebody first comes into office, they have about as much goodwill as they can have at that time, and everybody hopes that things get better for them. And so as we've taken a look and we've seen, for instance, public opinion polls done of presidents coming into office and so forth, they've usually been pretty high. And so, for instance, when President Kennedy came to office, his initial approval rating was at 72%. President Obama's was at 78%. Even George W. Bush, who went through the very controversial election of 2000, came into office with a 51% approval rating. So, again, it's been a way by which to gauge presidencies and support for them. And this time, we've seen in Donald Trump somebody who came into office with 45% approval. And I think most people figure that's a reflection of the contentious election that he went through. And I think his willingness to shake up things and to do things in a very unconventional way.
Now, one of the things that and you and I had discussed this even before the election while the primaries were still going on, the fact that he is a non-traditional candidate. In fact, most of us didn't expect him to become our next president. However, one of the things that some people are pointing out is the fact that is it because he's not a politician, he doesn't have that experience, that he felt like perhaps he needed to keep all his campaign promises in the first 3 days or four?
Well, I think, Louis, what in part we see going on is that this is somebody who, as you've said, isn't the traditional politician and who ran a campaign saying, I'm going to shake up Washington and we're going to do things differently, whether people like it or not, and I'm going to bring you results. So he went in there, I think, with that sort of mindset that he doesn't have to follow the path of Reagan or Kennedy and try to gain support. He's going to do what he wants to do. And if you don't like it, that's too bad. If you do, come along. We'll bring about some dramatic change here. And that up to now, again, and still, we're just looking at 100 days. You know, he's got some ways to go. I just checked the Gallup polls. In fact, those numbers that I've given you all have come from Gallup because they've tracked this perhaps longer than any other polling organization. And right now, his approval rating is at 39%. It's at a historic low for a president coming into 100 days. Normally, most of them have worked their way upward. And even as Kennedy, after 100 days, had an 83% approval rating. But again, that's at an earlier time with a different mindset within the American public. And
even though you said that the 100-day gauge was established during FDR because of what he said, however, other historians or other political scientists have now taken that gauge and going back to, say, Lincoln, Grant, and look at what they established during their first 100 days.
Oh, absolutely. Because and I think that it's probably more true now than in the past. And that is that presidents have come to realize that one of the first things they have to do in office, at least in terms of legislation and policy, is pass that signature piece of legislation that they consider to be the hallmark of their presidency. And so it is. I guess it would be 1981 when President Reagan was in office. One of the first things he went after right away was a sizable tax cut, because he had promised that he was going to bring down tax rates, going to try to grab hold of interest rates and so forth. And sure enough, that was his first piece of legislation. The same thing was true with George W. Bush, another sizable tax cut. And of course, we saw Barack Obama with his signature piece of legislation being the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. And so it is this time when we take a look to see what's their significant piece of legislation, and almost what's their legacy going to be? Because in many ways, it gets cast within those 100 days.
And so, as you mentioned, President Obama and Obamacare, Affordable Care Act, we heard throughout the campaign Trump saying that he was going to do away with this, needed to be redone. And now he's doing that, but a lot of people are, you know, raising their eyebrows as to what's the difference and why are you doing it again so fast?
Right. Well, and again, Louis, this 100 days, but then also when, as you mentioned, healthcare is such a Gordian knot with so many complexities associated with it, and it has such a huge impact on society, and goes to our basic question of what's the role of government in society, that it took President Obama until the middle of next year. In fact, it was in March of 2002 when he got his legislation passed through both chambers of Congress. A very complicated, very contentious piece of legislation. And it speaks to just how complicated it is. And especially now that it's been in office, how do you take back something that people have come to accept for better or worse? And the Republicans are finding among themselves that it's hard to reach agreement. And there are any number of ways you can take a look at it, whether by chamber, the House versus Senate, region, South versus Midwest versus Northeast and so forth, on the basis of ideology. It's really hard to gain consensus. And then, of course, just a few days ago, we saw the report from the Congressional Budget Office that put out their numbers, and that's made it that much more complicated. So it might have been Speaker Ryan's hope that they could get this through in a short period of time. But just by its very nature, it's so complicated. And that's so, Louis, even though we know the Republicans control both chambers of Congress, the Democrats control both chambers of Congress after the Obama election. And it took them a long time to get this through. It's tough, again, to pass this kind of legislation.
One of the things that people were alarmed they were alarmed when President Obama was in office and his executive orders. And then President Trump was inaugurated and he started issuing executive orders almost on a daily basis. And so my question would be, what is an executive order? How does that work? Examples of other presidents who have used those executive orders.
Well, we've seen executive orders as obviously written demands or control efforts by the president to control the executive branch, which in fact he is as the chief executor. And in the past, we've seen presidents issue them, not in the way that we've seen with presidents Obama and Trump, who really upped the number of executive orders from them and from their administration. And often in the past, the general explanation has been that legislation could work itself through and that it was possible to get things done. It might take a little bit of time, but the legitimacy of getting it through the Congress and then signed by the president to make it into law that way through the statutory process was much better than for a president to all of a sudden start to issue orders. But President Obama believed that he was getting no help from the Congress generally, the Republicans in the Congress in particular. And so he took the step to start issuing these executive orders. And now President Trump is doing much the same. He's in office now. He's going to bring about change. He wants to do it quickly. And so it is. He's going to get the executive branch to do certain sorts of things. Obviously, you know, it's not so cut and dry. The Congress, for instance, still has control of the budget. And that is one of their big checks on him. But we've seen with, again, from Barack Obama to Donald Trump, this surge in the use of executive orders as a way for presidents to get things done, whether it is to do them quickly or because they believe that the other chamber, or I should say the other institution, in this case the Congress, and in part also the judiciary, won't approve of what it is they're doing and what they've wanted or promised to do in their campaign.
We're visiting with a professor, political scientist, Dr. Gregory Rocha. We're talking about the history of how a president is gauged and graded over the first 100 days. Greg, you were talking about executive orders, and some people may wonder, okay, well then, can an executive order be overturned? And if not, what is to keep a president from keeping on issuing executive orders to get his or her way? And what happens to checks and balances?
Well, we saw that happen, Louis, with the first of President Trump's efforts to try to put greater controls over people from certain regions of the Middle East or certain countries in the Middle East. That was challenged through the courts, and things started to slow down that way. And an effort to try to overcome that slowdown in the courts, a new executive order was issued. But even then, this attorneys general from, I believe it's Washington State and Hawaii, have challenged the constitutionality of those particular orders. Again, we're looking at least an effort to try to put a check on the executive and to see, is this in fact a constitutional step by the president?
Because of social media, a lot of times, and the fact that people want to be the first to report it or to talk about it, sometimes that gets in the way of good journalism, and the fact that that story, perhaps those facts are not all checked because they want to be the first to air it or get a scoop on someone. So my question is, with all this social media going on and people communicating back and forth and sometimes not even reading it before they share it and talk about it, How has this affected President Trump and his relationship with the press?
More than any other president we've seen, has probably the most contentious relationship with the press generally, and particularly the mainstream media, which he just has little regard for, little respect for them. And I think he's used that in a way to further his own agenda of trying to do things quickly, to do it in the face of opposition, to shake up things. And his point would be, you know, one of the institutions that needs to be rethought or changed and so forth is the media itself. It's not the Congress, nor is it the judiciary. Regardless, it's one of these institutions in Washington, and the way that it goes about doing things needs to be changed fundamentally. And we're seeing that, I think, challenged by him. And he's getting a lot of pushback. And it's creating, I think, quite a flurry out in the public as they try to sort out, you know, well, what do I believe? What do I not believe? And how far should I take this? How far he'll get along with this, Louis, I guess we'll have to see. 100 days in, it's been something of a standoff here. I don't think he's gained any particular advantage over them, although he continually pushes at them. And that seems to be how he's run his business affairs. Very aggressively.
Some of the people who have been standing on the sidelines and watching, even though they are in Washington, some of them have said that perhaps he does not understand how the presidency works. He's not. He still thinks he's candidate Trump. And also the fact that he's used to having his own way with everything, being the CEO of all his companies and fortunes, etc. Is that the case? And if that's the case, does somebody step up and talk to him or try and talk to him and say, look, this is the way it has to be done, such as, when President Lincoln selected his team of rivals?
Perhaps so. But we're still pretty early in, almost in 100 days. But he's surely, you and I have spoken about before, doing things very differently. And surely there's part of this old CEO of my company and I run things my particular way. And for all his interaction with politicians over his lifetime, that doesn't necessarily mean he knows how government functions, and that there might be a mix of that as well. And I think along with that, Louis, he's starting to see that particularly among the Democrats, there's going to be very strong resistance to what he wants to do. And for better or worse, I think we've seen our political parties evolve to a point where they think that any advantage that goes to the other party works to my disadvantage. So they're going to do, at best, nothing to further the interests of anybody in the opposite party. And that makes it all the more difficult to try to reach compromise.
And so do you feel like some of the people are afraid to tell him or perhaps criticize him because then they might be on his hit list?
That may be in part true, but at the same time, you could ask, what can he do to me? You know, what could he do to a senator who gets elected by the constituents in his or her state or to anybody else? I think particularly the Republicans probably feel that, you know, because he won the office, he does deserve the opportunity to do things a particular way, even though it's very, very unconventional. And maybe a little bit later, after these 100 days or so, there'll be some kind of assessment. Because there's no question, Louis, he is the leader of the Republican Party. And he's trying to shape it and mold it in a particular way. But in doing so, he's meeting up with a lot of resistance simply because he's not so willing to accept the fundamental tenets of the Republican Party, which is to minimize the role of government in society. And we'll see that with this healthcare issue. As he ran for the presidency, he promised again and again that everybody was going to be covered and properly covered with health care protection. But that's not the way it would be with this piece of legislation. So how do they square that? You know, that's something they'll have to work through. He said he's a businessman. He likes to cut deals and so forth. Well, this will be a chance for him to do that and to, you know, we'll see. Can he do it?
We've heard even before the election about the Russians and Vladimir Putin and hacking. Tell us a little bit about, as being the leader of the free world, about the relationship with other governments around the country, around the world, excuse me. And how does he compare to other situations with other leaders in the past?
Well, he's, as we can see, he once he got into office, he started to make calls to leaders around the world, which is a protocol, I think, for any president who comes into office. And he had Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, come to the United States and speak. And in part, he's followed that convention. But as we've seen, the eyes are cast onto his relationship with the Russians general and Vladimir Putin in particular. And that's still evolving. How the Congress addresses this issue of the relationship between the two is obviously going to take front and center attention, along with his relationship with Mexico, which is not started out very well at all. And the Mexican population is pretty upset right now with him and the way that they feel he's been treated. And if you see the rise of Mr. López Obrador, the presidential candidate on the left, who's gaining considerable popularity in the country, that could shake up things quite as well. Because, again, he is changing that relationship dramatically. And for as we know, for the past quarter century, we've altered our relationship and our economy locally to be much more outreaching toward Mexico as a trading partner.
And does this give an opportunity to Mexico to reach out to other trading partners, perhaps?
Oh, they have, and at least they've threatened to do so. And so, for instance, there's talk, for instance, of legislation in Mexico that would stop the sale of corn from the United States, and the Mexicans would purchase it from other Latin American countries. And that would be a huge hit for farmers, particularly in the Midwest, where they've relied so heavily on the Mexican market to purchase corn.
What about Vice President Pence? What role has he played? And I know it's only been, you know, few months since he took office, but what role has he played? Because traditionally in the past, most vice presidents have kind of not really played a major role. In fact, as you and I have discussed in the past, President Truman wasn't even advised or saw much of FDR until after he passed away, that the family came to him and said, "You need the help, Harry."
Well, I think, Louis, that started to change when Jimmy Carter came into office and got quite a bit of assistance from the then Vice President Mondale, and George Herbert Walker Bush was an integral part of the Reagan administration and so forth. So we have seen vice presidents increase their role in an administration. And we just saw the relationship between Joe Biden and Barack Obama was a pretty close one as well. And I think here what we have in Vice President Pence is, shall we say, more of an institutionalist and somebody who's served in Congress and who has ties and personal relationships with Speaker Ryan and others in the Congress, who can go out and try to reach out to those members, particularly the most conservative members, who have doubts about President Trump, and at least try to establish some kind of relationship, maybe some rapprochement, in order to make sure that legislation gets passed. So he's been pretty busy in Washington, speaking to those members who might have doubts about what he's doing, whether it's with executive orders or his approach to the health care legislation. He's had quite a bit to do to, again, keep things going and moving on track. And if I would say if there's somebody to watch in Washington right now in terms of what they're doing and what does it tell you about the direction of government and policy generally, would be Vice President Pence.
We talked before the election also, and a lot of people have also mentioned the fact that, we all are aware that the Supreme Court is missing one seat there because of the passing of Scalia, and Justice Scalia. So President Obama nominated a person, and it was pushed off until they said after the election. And now President Trump has made a nomination. So what happens now?
Well, that's getting attended to, and of course it's going to be first heard. And in fact, all the action is going to take place in the Senate because it's going to be the Senate Judiciary that first reviews Mr. Gorsuch and examines his record and so forth, and they'll go through it with a fine-tooth comb in the best and worst sorts of ways. And once that person gets the approval of the Senate Judiciary, approval or disapproval, then it's onward to the full Senate. And they're the ones who provide, as the Constitution says, advice and consent about whether or not that person sits in the office. But again, the Republicans have a majority in the Senate, and it looks as if he's going to get through. I frankly, Louis, I feel sorry for anybody who has to go through this process. They are examined in a way that we just haven't seen any one person get examined for public office. It's an awful way to get in, you know, into public office. But again, it's a lifetime appointment, and once you're there, you're free. You can do what you want to do. But it is brutal now.
And what about the relationships? You mentioned Russia a little while ago, and we talked about Great Britain. One of the relations that has always come up, and of course, Jimmy Carter had a lot to do with that, and that's as far as Israel and their relationship to other countries.
They're our strongest ally in the region. And whereas President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu didn't have a good relationship, that doesn't seem to be the case with Mr. Trump and Mr. Netanyahu right now. But there are other things brewing in the region that could create problems for this relationship. Right now, again, it looks like it's been resteadied, but there are no guarantees that things are going to remain the same. We've seen Iran start to assert itself. Syria is still quite a problem. And at least for right now, we can see that President Trump has doubled down with the Israelis generally, and Mr. Netanyahu in particular.
And it seems while the attention is being focused on Israel and other countries, that pretty much North Korea is doing whatever they want.
That's true. And that's often what they do. They, early on in an administration, try to draw the attention of the American president and serve as provocateurs to see just how far they can go with the testing of missiles or whatever. We'll have to see what President Trump's relationship with China and the prime minister there, can he reel in that aggressiveness of this new leader in North Korea?
Greg, we've talked about social media and the internet, everything that's available now. And no doubt there's something out there if people want to check and compare other presidents in their first 100 days. Should they just go to whitehouse.gov or should they – they can just Google U.S. presidents.
A good place to go if they want to just take a look at records and so forth is Gallup. They have been doing this since the 1930s. They've got a pretty good track record of this to take a look at how presidents rate. And that's just public opinion polls if they want to look at it that way.
Well, Greg, thank you so much for being with us here today and giving us your time and expertise. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
We've been visiting with political science and Professor Dr. Gregory Rocha. He's been talking about how presidents are graded during their first 100 days, and he's given us examples of not just President Trump, but President Obama, and all the way back to President Roosevelt. The Weekend is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Kim Garcia. Our producer is Lauren Terrazas. You've been tuned to The Weekend. I'm Louis Science.